We're live. All right. Thanks for joining us today. I'm here with Kevin Stoffman from Cherry. Cherry is a data analytics platform in the real estate side of things, and Kevin's the head of innovation over there. Appreciate you joining us today, Kevin. We're thrilled to have the conversation, especially as it relates to the innovation and data. It's always interesting to have conversations with the folks in those disciplines because, like, you know, people have always talked about data as the new gold or the new oil or whatever it is, but you know, it's often like misrepresented with respect to as a solution and not as a problem. And so like at the end of the day, you can take data aggregation platforms, but if you don't have good data on the input side of things, where does it come from, right? How do you make good decisions? If you put bad gas in a car, you're going to get a bad result. And so like, how do you think about that? We'll kind of cover off a little bit around there, but you know, looking forward to this chat. So everyone listening today, get in hell yes, as you know, we talk about the new buying experience for buyers in specifically property management space. And one of the things we like to talk about all the time is this new buyer's journey where, you know, we kind of come as sellers, we kind of come to the table under the assumption that the buyers often have more information about the problem or maybe other solutions than maybe we do, right? And so they're following their path to buy. But then we as sellers have like timelines and quotas and those things we need to hit. And so how do we create a positive engagement out of that? How do we engineer contact and relationships with these folks so that when they're seeking to solve the problem, they think of us, like all those kind of things. So those are kind of like what we always want to talk about. So Kevin, as we always start, oh, and one more thing, anybody who's listening today, if you've got any questions, please just throw them in the chat. And we'll get to them as they pop up. Or if you need pump ups or, you know, shout outs, that's awesome too. This is brought to you by IRCX. IRCX is AI remote maintenance software for property management. And let's get started. So let's get to hell yes. Kevin, so tell us a little bit about your background. How did you end up in this role of innovation? And what's the problem Cherry solves?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's been a long journey to get here. I'm 21 years in to the real estate business. Seen it from a bunch of sides. Spent half my career as a consultant, the other half either as a low-earning financial analyst or now as a prop tech executive for the last 6 years and change. I came to Cherry because I was working for, at the time, a competitor that was focused on visualizing data. Mm-hmm. We were trying to help, since this is focused on property managers, I'll stick to that example, property management executives understand what was going on with the portfolios that they manage, mostly in a dashboard interface, mm-hmm. But also with some spreadsheets and mapping tables. And the questions we always got from these executives were, well, how do I know that this information is accurate? How do I know that this unit count is accurate? How do I know that the property count is accurate? How do I know that the unit turn time is accurate? How do I know that the assets under management are accurate, et cetera, et cetera? So these things I'm looking at, these widgets, these charts are all pretty, but like if the unit count isn't good or the occupancy isn't correct or the average monthly rate is not correct or look and lease specials are inaccurate, like if I can't trust the data, mm-hmm. Actually take action. I can't deploy a maintenance person to a unit. I can't tell a leasing agent to unlock a special and lease a unit, right? Et cetera, et cetera. So when I arrived at Cherry, they were on the front end of that problem. It was making sure that all information, no matter where it's stored, gets brought together into one place, mm-hmm. standardized to a single data model, so that everyone across the organization agrees on the accurate definition of property or unit or tenant or investment vehicle or address or occupancy or ROI, et cetera. So that then you can do a lot of stuff with mm-hmm. that afterwards. The most real use case I can give often is about a large property management company has their lead to lease stuff in a CRM. Mm-hmm. What am I running? How many people are touring the space on site? How many people are touring it virtually? How many people are filling out guest cards? How many people are then turning those into applications? All of that data typically sits in one tool, and it's likely a different tool than where you're executing work orders, taking service tickets, collecting rent, booking amenities. Like, a lot of this stuff happens in different places. And so the information that's necessary to do those things is also recorded in different places. And if those systems don't talk to each other, you have a real problem, right?
Well, in this case, even if they do talk, they're talking different languages.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and without showing what the Cherry platform actually does live, basically we build pipelines from all of those systems into the Cherry platform, which has a warehouse underneath the hood. And then you can see in near real time, most of these systems are updating every night, but some of them update every 15 minutes, what information was loaded, when was it loaded, who loaded it, how long did it take, what guardrails did it follow, what validation rules did it have to adhere to before anyone could see the results of it, like, you know, lease end date can't be before lease start date. Right, loan amount can't be less than zero. Rent amount can't be less than zero. A lot of validation rules sit on top. And then what's the definition of each data field when it comes in? So does property in Yardi mean the same thing as property in Funnel, mean the same thing as property in Iris CX? And from there, then you have a single semantic model that then gets put into dashboards or reports or AI workflows downstream. And so the so what of all of this is now the acquisitions person who's responsible for finding a deal that somebody buys, the underwriter that makes sure the deal fits the investment mandate, the asset manager that's looking at leasing statistics across all their properties, the property manager that's responsible for leasing each of these properties, and the facilities that's responsible for doing the maintenance for each of these facilities, especially in this world of multifamily centralization. Now you have like one group servicing multiple properties, right? Now all of those people can communicate with one another with the same definition of the same piece of data.
So you talked about a couple of different groups there. You talked about ownership groups from the acquisition side of things and then management groups from the operation side of things. Yeah. Like, how do you, when you guys are out there in the market, where's the most amount of pull? Is it those that are seeking to manage, those that are seeking to aggregate data from an ownership perspective, or those that are seeking to aggregate data from a management perspective?
Both, but Cherry cut its teeth on the ownership side.
On the ownership side. Because I see, like, from an ownership perspective, like, especially on the M&A piece, like, there's a time wall. And this is one of the questions we always ask about the time wall, but, like, you got to do something in a certain amount of time, and there's not enough hours on earth to get that done by the time you have to get your bid in, right?
Yeah. So back when interest rates were lower and deal activity was more frenetic, this was a major, major, like, five alarm problem. To the point where people were trying to build automated valuation models, like, so they could get bids in quickly. When you're buying a larger apartment complex, it probably doesn't have to happen that fast, but it could be, it could be within, you know, days, not weeks, instead of hours. And very quickly, as an investor, you need to understand what lease comparables look like in nearby properties, what points of interest are nearby that property, what zoning looks like nearby that could turn into competitive supply.
Right.
What permitting information has been filed? Therefore, are there going to be buildings that are going to be pretty soon built to compete with yours?
Nice. Yes.
And is there any other government legislation problems that may put rent control on your buildings or require affordable housing components in the building? Right. All of that data, if it's brought
available, $100 million decision.
That is the attempt, right? It is speeding up while not increasing the risk, or massively reducing the risk while keeping the same speed, or in a perfect world, both.
Right.
And when you do that at scale, multiple regions across the US, or even multiple sub-property types, right? You might have market rate multifamily housing, you might have affordable housing, you might have a mix, you might have student housing, you might have military housing, you might have senior housing.
Yeah.
And all of those are going to have all their different nuances and different data types that need to be pulled together. So for the folks in this audience, if you are an investor in these properties, you just need to understand what data elements are critical to a go or no-go decision on whether to either buy outright or invest, and how much debt to put on top of investment. Or if you're participating in an investment group, which properties are worth, you know, writing your small checks. Because if you're a small investor in a big syndication, you're probably not going to receive a lot of ongoing information about the performance of that property. You just have to trust that it's doing well. And you need to do that diligence up front. You have to do it quickly, and bringing the data help together helps you do that.
Well, presumably, if you're the syndicator, you've got to warrant that deal to the syndicate, the syndicators. I don't know if these are right words there, but you know what I mean? You're the LPs, right? Sorry, thanks. Yeah. The LPs, because then otherwise you're going to be offside on your warrant, which puts liability on the syndicator.
Yep.
Interesting.
But if let's flip to the other side of that. Now you are the property manager, and now you're answering to multiple ownership groups. They've given you some portion of their portfolio for you to manage information. You might actually be using their systems. So like if I'm a property manager and I'm helping manage properties for JP Morgan and Oxford and Cortland and the ownership side of Graystar, whatever, right? I'm using their accounting systems.
Yep. We hear it all the time.
Bringing all of that data in and then using my own system for property performance, maybe maintenance, work order stuff. So now I need to make sure that I'm bringing in all of the relevant data from the right systems to kick off workflows. Mm-hmm. I also need all of that data ready, so when the ownership groups ask me how things are going, I can quickly answer. Mm-hmm. That's good. Great is just having an interface where they can just log in and see what's happening without even reaching out to you as the property manager. Therefore, you're not getting your time, not wasted, but your time used as an opportunity cost to reporting things out to them. It's automated instead.
So an interesting thing to double click on, with the context of getting to Hell Yes, because what you guys do, I did this for years in my previous career. And you know, one of the things that we had to battle all the time for dollars for harmonizing data, because it felt like data harmonization was it's like eating your Wheaties, right? It's like something everyone knows they should do, or eating your vegetables, let's say. Everyone knows they should do, but they just would rather do something else. How do you get top of the list? Or no, actually better yet, I forget sometimes the show we're on. How do you find that people that are looking to solve that problem? How do they articulate the problem in a way that reflects the pain they're going through?
Sure. We're actually, as Cherry, selling to two different audiences. Mm-hmm. So first, we're selling to the technical audience who's actually responsible for doing this, bringing the information together and making it available to the business. We shifted our business a lot in response to what they were telling us that they needed. Originally, we were an all-in-one platform. Integrate the data, build the model, build the dashboards, try to do some workflow. We wanted to be on all-in-one solution. Well, if you try to do that, you're now directly competing with the technical teams inside of a property management company or an ownership company. Sure. It's like you're taking away their budget, their team, their fiefdom, their control, their power.
Yeah.
And you know, some companies want to do that. They want to just completely outsource that function. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Most companies, ones that are looking to gain a competitive advantage and grow faster, they realize that some of that should actually be kept in-house, protected, private, built in-house. And so we've shifted the platform to say we will do all of the data integration, and make it available so that the CIO, the CTO, the head of applications can now answer questions quickly for the business. And then go hand in hand with them and then have to sell the COO or CFO on why a single data model is going to be a competitive advantage in their business. And like you just said, up and until 2 years ago, this was like an uphill battle, eat your Wheaties. We don't have a bunch of case studies to tell you why companies that do this outperform. They just do. Here's some stock quotes.
Yeah.
But then in early 2023, people started using ChatGPT.
Yeah.
Other AI models. And then they realized something first, and then realized something more, much more important second. The first thing they realized was, wow, I can do a lot of stuff really fast.
Yeah.
Plug in a question, get an answer. Boom. And then what they would
do an answer.
A couple of weeks later, it's like, wait, not all of those answers were accurate. I got speed, but I didn't get accuracy and I didn't get security. So now it just made the beta a lot higher, right? So now I can do a lot more. I could do a lot more better, or I could do a lot more worse.
Yeah. It's a cattle. It's horsepower, right? So I make the argument all the time. You can win the F1. You cannot win the F1 with just horsepower. Yeah. You need to have horsepower, steering, and brakes, right? Those three, and a driver and all those things. But like, you got to have all three. If you don't have steering, you're going to be all over the place. If you don't have horsepower, you're not going to win. And so like, and it's the balance of those things that create a winner.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't see that about AI. You know, I was using a metaphor the other day. It's a power drill. Like, I was trying to really simplify it, right? Like, it's a power drill or a screwdriver. Like, they pick a choice. But one just, you can strip a screw way faster with a drill than you can with a screwdriver, right? But that's not why you don't use it.
Yeah. That's a great example. If we stay with the F1 example, we're doing this live. So this
there you go. Risk. Yeah, I know. That's the best part.
We're doing it live. I'm going to try. When you get into the F1 car, that data model, that data warehouse is your engine, right? Yeah. It powers everything. The validation rules that you put on top of the warehouse to make sure that the data is adhering to the important nuances of your business, right? That's the steering wheel, right?
Yeah.
Then the technology office that's limiting access to information based on user groups and roles and who needs to see what and when, they're the brake pedal. Mm-hmm. And then everybody in the business, once you have everything else aligned, they're teaming together to press and press and press the accelerator pedal harder, mm-hmm. right? So if only asset management is using this tool, you press it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Acquisitions is using it, you press it more. Marketing is using it, you press it more. And all of a sudden, when the entire company is going the same direction, you can floor it.
Flying, you're flying.
Totally. Knowing that the steering wheel is going to work because you built the rules in place, you're going to apply the brakes at the right time because IT knows what is in the data model, and now you have a winning race car.
That's right. And you know, I love the result set, right? Like, if you don't do it this way, it's just going to be more work. It's going to be slower. Yeah. And you're going to be in a, it's just going to be more expensive, right? In this era of like having to activate around NOI and really like take data and make it a competitive positioning. I think that the one thing that, you know, if you look back at like the definition of real estate, right? Location, location, location. Okay. Well, what does that mean? Right. That means that it's inherently disaggregated. It's inherently fragmented. It's inherently unique. And so those things don't lend to common data models. And I applaud you guys leading the charge with Retsy and building a data model for multifamily. Because like, one of the things that we talked about at the BTR conference is that they also are seeking a common data model, a common Rosetta Stone that you can begin to use to interchange data. Because, you know, we can't, I don't see a world where Yardi is going to be the marketplace of all data interchange. That's not a marketplace. It's a system of record. And so like we can't put the onus on Yardi to be the translator for all the data that comes to the system. There's got to be an interface, right? And there's got to be a standard. And like, when we adopt standards, just one second, we get massive success. Look at the www3. Look at the Bluetooth is a standard, like technology standards. Like, you get massive adoption when you commit to a standard to solve a common problem.
And I do think like, kind of Yardi above all else, they just what they've been able to do as an operating platform, I think they've grown massively, mm-hmm. introduced a lot of unique modules to try to address a lot of that downstream workflow, right? And portals for collecting rent, investment management modules for consolidating financial information. They've really thought about the whole journey, but they're only one provider. Mm-hmm. And a lot of companies, they'll grow by acquisition and then have to be using multiple systems. And we had some people ask us about the common data model, right? This it's called BITS 5.0. It's what NMHC is using. It's what we've helped them build. Nothing about the model is dictating how anybody should run their business, right? So if you think about it, like let's use parking as an example. Depending on where you live in the world, you're going to have different parking stall requirements, ways you bill for the parking, right? Sometimes you might have generalized parking spots that are open to everybody first come, first serve, and you're paying a fee behind a security gate. Or you might have your own dedicated spot, but it happens to be outdoors submitted to the weather. Mm-hmm. Or you might have a outdoor spot that is also covered from the elements and then it's connected to an EV charger. Or there might be a private garage, right? There's all these different ways you could do parking and monetize parking and provide or not provide access to parking. But all of those potential fees and the way you monetize them should be brought together and treated as parking. Mm-hmm. That way, no matter how many different apartment complexes you buy with different monetization strategies and different mandates in different places, you bring it all together. Now you can report up to your executives. You can report out to LPs. You can report to your clients. You can report to your auditors, right? You can do all of this to a standard without interrupting what makes the competitive advantage of each unique property get you more money.
Mm-hmm. It's like the FDA, right? Makes it safe to eat.
Yeah. And there, that's interesting you say that, because there's a big debate going on right now on requiring pharmaceutical companies to test drugs, not just for safety, but also for efficacy. And there's a big, not on this call, political debate we have on whether you need to require studies for efficacy, or if you're okay just doing studies for safety, because what you want to do is open up the marketplace of ideas. Mm-hmm. That's what you want to do with this unified data model.
The model
Etsy is like, hey, run the business whatever way you want to run the business, and then bring the information in so that you can be benchmarked against your peers. Or if you want to advertise your properties in all these internet listing services, commonly known as ILSs, all of that data is going to go into the ILS, and a potential tenant will very easily see, here's my cost for rent, here are all the potential fees I might pay, here are all the amenities I might be able to book. And you can do an apples to apples comparison as a renter. And like it makes it a well-functioning marketplace.
Yeah, I mean, otherwise it's kind of like Craigslist versus it's like the car listing service, right?
CarMax.
Yeah, it's like Craigslist, where it's just like unstructured, blobby. I call it blobby data, right? Yeah. Blobby data that is unstructured. We're lucky Craigslist is textual, not visual. But when you start getting into how you actually close deals, you got to have visual context. So now we're getting into multimodal data, where you've got video, you've got the 3D, the Matterport type experience, and then in addition, you've got the kind of like contextual data and metadata around a specific listing, and all that's got to be standardized, because for humans, it's just a lot of work to read unstructured data. Like, people don't know that we process things in columns. We scan down and scroll right. That's how like the original DB was designed, because that's how we process, right? And we do that way. And we want to have the data structured so we can make a decision fast. If you had to choose everything through like a Craigslist type data structure, it would be exhausting. It would be impossible. And so by solving these problems of data structure, you make it easier or the resident or the consumer or the partner to do business with you, because you just took away all that overhead that they otherwise might have to do. So now, one of the things about data that I struggled with was that it often doesn't show up as a priority this quarter. But if we don't get it right, we know it's going to be something, you know, it's like eating your veggies or whatever, like, or saving money. Like, it's not a lot of fun to do. It's difficult to underwrite it. Using real estate terms, as a project, because it's like it's difficult to connect. How do you manage that? Like, how do you find people that are what are they considered What problem are they trying to solve when they finally realize they can't do something about it until the data is fixed?
So that depends on the size of company. Sure. So I'll break it down to large enterprise companies, and then I'll call it the middle market and lower
market. Yeah.
The large enterprise companies, you know, they are ready to commit to, you know, fully eating their Wheaties, as you said, when they start like an official procurement process.
Yeah.
So I used to hate RFPs, RFQs, RFIs for those that don't have to do that on a daily basis. So request for proposal or request for quote. There's some sort of formal procurement process that's happening where they're saying, here's the problem we're trying to solve. Here's what we want in our response. We're going to rank all the bidders, and then, you know, we're going to narrow it down to a list of a couple of finalists, and you're going to come in and you're going to do presentations on why you think you're the best, and then you're going to give us your best price, and then we're going to choose one.
Yeah.
The downside of that is you have to do a bunch of work for something you might not win. Yeah. But the upside of that is, you know, as a company, they are committed to doing this because they've put budget aside. They've put a committee in place to choose a tool. They've usually tapped somebody to like be in charge of that project if they do pick a winner and it's won. So at large companies, absent of it an actual RFP being issued, we are trying to get in front of them and get them to budget us for the following year. Mm-hmm. So right now at the beginning of May 2025, I've very likely already missed the window for them to do business with us in a meaningful way in 2025, because we're not a point solution, right? No. We're not solving one little problem. We are
implementing. No, your enterprise, your EDW, right? Your enterprise architecture, yes. Your all those things. You're the hard work.
Yeah. So most of these companies, if they're doing a calendar year, fiscal year, they're starting the budget process when they get back from summer vacation. Right. Yep. So like Labor Day is like the unofficial kickoff budget season.
I know, it's the best.
And then they're usually wrapping it up before Thanksgiving. So like that's the window of time where like we have to officially be called out as a line item in their budget for the following year. But what does that mean? I need to be doing back now in May. I need to be getting advocacy at the company. Why would you benefit? What's the so what? Am I? Any solution that our clients buy has to do one of three things: increase revenue, reduce cost, or reduce risk. And ideally, a little bit of all three. Mm-hmm. But if it doesn't do at least one of those things, you're not getting budget, you're not getting purchased. Right?
You know, how does that – so on those three things, right, how do those show up? Like how does
– what do you mean?
Cost revenue is revenue, and revenue has a natural kind of time dimension to it. But costs and risk are interesting. We talked about the owners and acquisition perspective has a cost and have a risk problem.
Yep.
Cost is an interesting one, especially when it comes to data. And
will having all the data in the right place help you optimize upfront capital costs for projects? Yep. Will it help you optimize ongoing operating costs? So we are if you buy our software platform, we're software as a service. So there's some annual fee. Will paying us the annual fee save you multiples of that annual fee in reduced OPEX, either in direct costs of people or other software, or indirect costs in terms of time, right? Time to complete a task. Yeah. That becomes an opportunity cost to do something else. If I'm spending a bunch of time trying to close the books at the end of the month, am I actually able to optimize my property for the right amenities and the right leasing tenants? Probably not. Right. So, and then the risk would be like risk of missing a deal, risk of financial misstatement, a need to do a restate. Like there's a bunch of elements you could pull into to that calculator.
I find what's interesting is that like, conventionally, the kind of like the calculator is kind of like it's irrespective of time. And I'll follow on this in a second, meaning that we kind of do, here's what it costs you today. Here's what it could cost in the future on Iris or on Cherry, whatever. Right. And so like, but then I'm finding right now in the double click that I'm getting a lot of conversation around cycle time, because like they're And the reason why cycle times are becoming interesting conversation. I got two deals right now. The buy ROI is because they need to do things faster. It isn't because they're going to save money, no doubt about it. But the pain that they're trying to solve is speed. And it's an interesting one because you talk about revenue cost risk, right? And speed is a horsepower element to all those three, right? You can be riskier. You can spend more money. You save more money. You can grow or whatever, right? And so it's like, it's interesting in that for them, what they were most interested in was that we could cut down, like, you know, triage time from like, let's say 72 hours down to like 5, right? And they're like, okay, now my business cycles can speed up. So to your month end example, if month end takes 5 days, right? Let's say 10 days, average month end. So that means it takes me 120 work days to do month end. Now, if my month end took one, which means I'm vulnerable to accruals, data accuracy, insight, you know, to make decisions about my business. So I've got 12, let's call it, I have 12 decision points. I have 12 times I can make those kind of decisions a year because the data's got to be prepped and it takes 10 days to do it, et cetera. But if month end was automated, I could get, and it was like a daily close. Now I have 220 times where I can make that, or 140 times where I can make that decision. And so now my business is different because if I was making it 12 times to 220 times, now I'm like 20x more confident around my data. And that matters to some businesses. I'm not saying it matters to property management. And so when we talk about this cycle time for work orders, as an example, if I can take my cycle time from 72 hours to like 5 hours, the difference between cycle time creates value. And one of the things that I didn't, you know, we do a lot of our ROI calculations for customers, and everyone does this, is we don't think about the frequency that now you can execute something with the same resources. And that can be a greater multiplier on ROI than just saving money. So if I can save money and do it in the same amount of time, that's interesting. But if I can save money and do it in a quarter of the time, now I just got 4, 5, 10x more efficient. And I'm finding that to be a recurring conversation in the operations side because they've got to go faster with less resources and with neutral risk.
And it also, it creates upward mobility. Right. We have this massive problem, especially in the property management industry, of high turnover. So yep. You know, people, you know, go from one company to the next. They're taking tribal knowledge with them. It's harder to train new people up. And often what I usually hear is people don't leave bad companies. They leave bad bosses. Yep. And if you're reporting up to someone that is insisting that you use outdated technology and do something manually that is not very fun, it's just one of those like menial, boring, repetitive tasks, but you have to do it. You have to check the box because, you know, you have to get units cleaned. You have to get work orders submitted. You have to get somebody access to a building, like all these things, right? That if you automated them, now you've freed up a person's time day to day to learn more about the business, to get a little bit more strategic, to think a little bit more critically and be able to become more of a problem solver. Now, so now not only can one person do the job of two on site, but now they feel like they have more control over their job, over their time, over their day. And that helps with talent retention. And it also helps you train people to do the next job at the next level up.
Well, I think it's also like, if you when you get into some jobs or roles, you end up doing personality profiles and learning profiles and eDisc and all those things. And like, you know, the first time you do it, you kind of learn about yourself. When you start leading a team, you start thinking about like, how can I optimize their strength, right? And one thing that this is what words of one of our customers, I love it. It's one of my favorite words of all or interviews of all. Is he talked about how the people, these maintenance techs, they have a different kind of genius. And I was like, okay, let's click on this a bit. He's like, we're not really good at filling in forms. It's not our strength is filling out forms or working spreadsheets, right? That may not be our strength, but our strength is the physical space. and you have to have us to understand that spatial space. I was like, okay, cool. Because what they love about what Iris does is they make that form piece, the automation piece, go away, and they can just focus on the stuff that they love to do, which is like solving people's problems in the physical space. And like I found that acknowledging that people have a different strength package, right?
Yeah,
is a conscientious approach to the people that you have on your team, so you can make everybody successful. Because as leaders or managers, like I was talking to somebody else in the show, is that the dolphin never wins the tree climbing competition. Very clumsy. I probably should tune that up. But like at the end of the day, you should put the dolphin in the pool and put the monkey in the tree climbing competition, and you're gonna have a great outcome for everybody. It's gonna be easier, less work. It's gonna be faster results. And often we try, and I really empathize with these people in operations roles, is that they have a different kind of genius, but people that build systems assume that everyone thinks that people that build like that. People that build systems assume that people that use systems think like them.
Yeah.
And it's just not true. And so I enjoy these conversations to kind of like explore that a little bit, because I think one of the benefits of AI, we've leaned in this quite a bit, and other competitors as well, is that like we're using AI to create data so that we can actually use it for decision making. Meaning that like on Iris, if you talk to it and show it, right, we can use AI to create the work order. Versus, and it'll be perfect, right? It'll have all the boxes ticked. It'll have all the types all figured out, because it's all automated. Versus having a person go through like some of the forms that people have to click through for an inspection is like it's overcooked, and so the data gets bad because you end up having a lot of like non-structured data. So here's the example for everyone before we get too kind of geeky on this, is like purchase orders. So like text PO or maintenance, text POs versus a structured PO. So text PO is someone just wrote in buy toilet filter, and a structured PO is like, it's a drop down, it's a material item. I can see how much is left and all those things. I know the price, I know what the spec is. I know it's gonna work for this unit. Those are two different approaches to data management. And in this business, I see a ton more text POs, which then kind of like makes the data management part hard. So where I'm getting with all this is that when you're looking at this appreciation for data in what you guys sell, like the problems that you solve, you talked about scale, like at what point does it start to become a problem that they've got it, that they're starting to write that RFP? Like when you're starting to sort your prospects, I mean, we talked about like, mom and pop may not do it unless they're kind of a sophisticated mom and pop, but as you're getting into like a certain unit count, what unit count do you guys typically like to start selling into?
And from a multifamily perspective, probably 2,000 units would be where we'd start.
Yeah.
Because at 2,000 units, if we're averaging 150 to 200 units per property,
mm-hmm.
states. All right, now you're over 10 properties. It's probably in multiple cities. You have different people with different styles of doing business, running things their own way, using their own tech to solve the problem. That level of complication, now you got to bring the data together. And then that would then enable them to, at a high level, run their business from wherever HQ is. And that's mm-hmm. usually what draws the buying signal, is somebody up top says, why is it so hard for me to answer these questions that 2 years ago used to be so simple to answer? Like mm-hmm. we bought three more properties and now no one can tell me anything about anything. Why is that? Right? That drives the buy. The only other thing I would say to take your per purchase order
mm-hmm.
Example one step further, having things in a dropdown so you can enter the information is good. Having that information in one place is better. But then once our clients take all that information and then get predictive,
yes,
and go from reactive to proactive, or yes. maintenance by work order to preventative maintenance before a work order ever happens, that's best, right? Mm-hmm. So now instead of it being, oh, the tenant in unit 3C is complaining that the air conditioning, something's up. We go check it. Oh, it's because the filter needs to be changed.
Yeah.
We changed it, all set. Well, what if instead, like in the system, it said that we put the new filter in 3 months ago, filters last this of this brand kind with this this unit type because of the number of uses and the hours, the ACs on whatever, it typically lasts 3 or 4 months. We're getting toward the end of the useful life of that filter, but just have somebody on their rounds go do a quick check. Oh, looks like it needs to be replaced. Replace it. Done. Tenant never even had to ask. And now you've enhanced the tenant experience and what whatever, whatnot. And you didn't have to process things in work order because you just need to do it.
So then like, and then I guess the thing is that I always struggle with this again, like those things are ideal states, right? Yeah. For a lot of people, it's an imagined ideal state.
Yeah.
And like the priority to buy this quarter, next quarter, or even budget for 2026, you know, they've got to be suffering through something. Like, are there external forces? Like, is it ever insurance or bankers that force the data issue as a priority?
Insurance drives some of it because, you know, premiums go up, either due to incidents at the property. And now they want to increase their premiums on you, or, they think you're in an area that's prone to force majeure events. So they're going to raise premiums on you anyway, or, you have leverage on the property and now that floating rate loan is coming due and you got to refinance it. And when you have to do the refinancing, the bank wants to dig into every detail about the properties and approve the refinancing. Well, if you can't get them that information and they don't approve that refinancing, now you're forced to sell the asset.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably not ever at like the ideal time when the market's at the peak. So you lose money, then the investors get mad. Investors get mad, that lowers your chance of raising the next fund. So it all like dominoes. Mm-hmm. So what starts like small things can then, if they're not addressed, snowball into much bigger problems that then aren't affecting a property manager or a leasing manager or a site manager or even the head of asset management. Like now it's up to the CFO or COO, and you never want it to get there.
Mm-hmm. Right?
You want to fix the problem before it does. But it usually has to get there before they're willing to budget for something like this.
Do you ever find customers like kind of the adage of best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, next best time is today? Like at that 10, 20, at the 2000 unit level that are like, no, we're going to do this the right way. Like we're going to set up our GL the right way and we're going to set up our data the right way. And this is how we're going to live. And because like my experience of data migrations, like it was always the last 20% of data that created 80% of the work in trying to harmonize it. And so how do you like, it's kind of like unfair. I'll put it this way. It's unfair. And that the people that realize a problem could have solved it a long time ago. Right. Because had you started at 2000 units, let's say 20,000 units, had you started at 2000 units on Cherry, or at least with a culture around data, you wouldn't have the problem you have today. Like how is that?
Yeah, it's very, very, very driven by companies who have growth in their mandate. Yeah. Like if someone is managing 1500 units today, because they're the second generation of a family portfolio, and they say, you know, like, this is a great lifestyle business. My team's staying with me. We have a way of doing things. We don't want to change.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really fault them for doing that, right? Cash flowing. The properties probably have low or no debt on them. And they don't really want to grow.
Yeah.
Okay, keep running the business.
Yeah.
But if you want to go from 1,500 units to 5,000 units, that requires a very different muscle, right? It requires different access to capital, more centralized operations and processes, more sophisticated technology, and probably some level of like company-wide culture so that you can make sure that the standards at one property are the same standards at another in terms of performance. Mm-hmm. And to do that, you usually have to have something to measure. You have to be able to measure the performance of your people,
mm-hmm.
Measure the performance of your processes. Like that is usually when that investment will happen. And it's only going to be driven by growth or by some like really, really critical event that's like threatening the viability of the business. It's usually one of the two things.
I do like that point for everyone to hear, is that the time wall that emerges is self-imposed in terms of like, we made these commitments to LPs or shareholders or however. And then the other one is, you know, something has gone very bad that we need to solve, and that needs to be solved because of the compliance or, you know, license to operate. Right. And those create actions. So how do you find people that are looking to grow?
Most of them are coming to industry conferences.
Yeah.
Right. Like they are actively seeking solutions, right? Because they've either as an executive, they want to do it themselves, or they are a lieutenant to an executive that's been sent to go, quote unquote, solve these problems. So if they're there, they're already taking the first step.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, they're getting there and they're getting like flooded.
Yeah.
A bunch of people trying to get their time when they're face to face. They're flooding their inbox with emails, flooding their LinkedIn with messages.
Like, yeah. These
people are getting peppered. So to get through to them, like, you have to be seen as more of a partner, more of an advisor, more of a thought leader to them. Like, you're their friend before you're their service provider in most cases. There are exceptions, of course, but at most of the people that, at least personally, that I assist that are clients of Cherry now, like, it was a couple of years of like us getting to know each other before we actually started like really working together.
Interesting.
In a meaningful way. So
no, that's a good take for everyone to listen for, is that the psychology of investing in a conference, because conferences aren't free. You know, they're that means you're actively seeking a solving a problem. I love it.
And so, most of the time, the folks that are there that are either large property managers or large property investors, mm-hmm. They're not always paying for the conference tickets, right? The conferences are telling them, please come, we need buyers there. So they'll get free tickets, but it doesn't mean it's free for them to go. Right? Like, they got to buy the plane ticket. They got to buy the hotel.
They're not at work.
Yeah. Like it's a job. So like there's a time cost for mm-hmm. them going there, even if there's not an economic one.
Yep.
And so you don't want to come across as wasting their time. You want to come across as making their time valuable and being helpful. And then like eventually they will ask a buying question. Mm-hmm. And the best way to get a long-term client is if they ask a buying question and it's not something that you do directly, it's, we don't do that, but I know someone who does, let me go introduce you. If you're seen as helpful, you build the relationship. If you're seen as just trying to like sell your widget every time, like your email's going to be go in the spam folder. It's going to jump.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard that the selling never helps. Helping always sells, right?
Yes.
You know, it's a good approach. Yeah. What kind of objections do you guys hear?
So today, the exception is very different than the exception.
Objection.
Yeah. So when I joined 2.5 years ago, there was the most common competition was build versus buy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, hey, what you're proposing, I want to build myself.
Yeah.
When we shifted, and then it became, you know, we return control back to you. So now, actually, the most common, maybe not objection, but question, wanting of clarification is, well, you're 7 years old now. You've raised a few rounds of venture capital. What's your roadmap look like? I mean, is someone going to buy you in the next 2 years? And if somebody buys you, what happens to my work? Like, mm-hmm. do your prices jump up? Do I have contractual protections?
Interesting.
The other question is usually around data compliance and data security, because we now have a bunch of global clients. We have pension funds, we have banks, we have insurance companies. Like, their information is valuable, and there's legal liability to data breaches. So that we get a lot of questions around how is the data encrypted while at rest? How is it encrypted while in motion? What information is in my control in my four walls versus being handled by Cherry? There's a lot of, I'll call it, much higher level, higher risk questions that are objections. It's not really about, does your platform work, or do you have references you can introduce me to? Like, we're beyond that. Of course, we have a bunch of quality.
Well, interesting. Like, I'm just
much more longer term strategic objections on, well, if we choose you, we're now like depending on you, at least for part of our technology stack. And so we need to know that like 2 years from now, like it's still going to be market leading and it's still going to be around and we're not going to get bait and switched.
Interesting. I'm in the third week of a PIA right now, privacy impact assessment right now. And it's,
yeah,
like I know what all of our sub-processors do and how they do it. And it's, yeah, it's more than I wanted to learn this last 3 weeks. 100%. So we'll close it out real quick here. As a role of innovation, how does the role of innovation that we talked a lot about sales and revenue generation, how do you apply your hat of innovation to the growing of growing the business?
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? My role is not a sales role officially. I don't have any accounts tagged to my name. We have a wonderful sales team. They go do their sales job. My two main jobs, one is around corporate development. So M&A due diligence, are there other companies we need to partner with and maybe bolt on as workflows to our platform. But my main job is building new revenue channels. So not going to one client to buy our platform, but introducing the world of Cherry to a channel partner, right? Mm-hmm. Having a large services company that would benefit from our technology, help them sell a bunch more services to newer clients or additional services to the same clients they already have. So net new plus account expansion, I'm trying to help companies leverage our platform to do that. And so what that means is like training them up on our platform, developing a certification program so that they can go out and be smart about what our platform helps them deliver, and then help them think of new offerings that they could basically white label, that it looks like everything from them on the outside, but we're helping to power it from the inside.
Very, very interesting. Well, that's a follow-up for you and I to check in on, because it'd be very, there's now I got to focus on closing this off. Lots of ideas there.
I gave you a tangent. This is why you're live, man.
That's lots of ideas there. When you take a look at folks that you, you know, the younger self, the younger Kevin, or maybe even people that you're working with today that are coming on board, what's the one, you know, and specifically around the context of getting to Hell Yes, what's the moment, what kind of advice do you like to give them?
Oh, man. This is not original advice. This is advice I was given. Wish I had listened to it more. Well, actually, a couple points. One, you have two ears and one mouth. Use them in that ratio. Right? Listen more than you talk. Number two, when you're in a meeting, I know this is so hard to do in today's digital realities. If you're in a meeting, make sure that it is a critical meeting for you to be in. If it's not, leave the meeting. We have note takers for a reason. We have AI recorders for a reason, right? You don't need to be in that meeting. But if you do need to be in that meeting, do not multitask. Don't open other windows. Don't check email. Don't be looking at spreadsheets. Don't be looking at your phone. If you're in the meeting, it needs to be critical enough for you to say, I'm in this meeting for a reason, and therefore I'm focusing on the person I'm meeting with. It makes it a lot more valuable. For years, I tried to multitask thinking I was going to get more done. And all it was a distraction. It slowed me down. And I'm a lot more curative about my calendar. Like I delegate a lot of things, but if I'm in something, I'm in it.
Very, very powerful. I think there's a lot to be there, especially when we're in a world of asking questions, as you mentioned, versus like just intaking. Like the question asking is another one. Like he who controls the questions, though the one that controls the questions controls the conversation.
Yeah.
But it's if you can be in a position, you have to be committed to the conversation if you're going to ask questions. Otherwise, you're just kind of like making sure you're heard correctly, which is different than guiding the conversation with a question, the double click, right?
Yeah.
Very powerful. That's awesome. Who should we talk to next?
Oh, man. So I know you've spoken to a friend of mine, from high school who runs Durango Turnkey Services.
Oh, Nick, he's a beauty.
Yeah. Have you talked to Jindu Lee at Happy Co?
Talked to Ben. You know what? I'll get a hold of Jindu. We should have him on.
He's great. Tyler Christensen at Funnel. Also great. This is probably not a new topic for you guys, but the idea of fraud prevention in multifamily is like going insane. So
no folks in fraud. The other interesting one is maintenance fraud that no one's talking about.
What companies is Iris focusing on?
Well, centralization begins to mitigate maintenance fraud. But maintenance fraud is like something that you got to change the way you do work in order to mitigate it. It's less about seeking it out and like the leasing side of things, where it's like seeking it out and preventing it. On the maintenance side, it's about lack of controls. And so like an environment where you've got high turnover, you've got localized procurement, localized job description, localized invoice approval, right? And remote payment is like super easy to start engineering fraud around faulty invoices, faulty timesheets, no parts, no replacement, an invoice around replacing a toilet, but there was no toilet, like that kind of stuff. It's really easy to do. And I'm waiting for that conversation to surface because it's been really uncomfortable to start asking people about it.
Yeah, I feel like most of the money, the VC money and the operating companies are attacking tenant.
Yeah, leasing fraud.
So Vero, Get 100, whatever the ones that Yardi and MRI bought. But maintenance fraud, that's interesting.
Like, look at for anyone listening, just Google field services fraud.
Okay.
You're going to get the International Fraud Auditors Report, and it's going to make you throw up a little bit, but that's what happens.
So if I'm ever tempted to like snack late at night on candy, just go Google that and I'll get a little
more. The forensic auditors report, and you'll see where real estate ranks, and you just might throw up a little bit.
Okay. Either that or I'll fall asleep.
How can folks get a hold of you?
LinkedIn is the only social platform that I'm on. So just find me here on LinkedIn. It's just Kevin Schaffman. If you want to learn more about Cherry, our website is available. Most people, because I pronounce it cherry like the fruit, misspell it. It's C-H-E-R-R-E. It's like the cherry on top of real estate.
There you go.
It's our website. Just go to the website. Reach out to me. I respond to every message. I do not respond to connection requests without messages.
There you go. Perfect. Well, thanks everyone for listening today. Kevin, thanks so much for your insight. I do love the conversation, the commitment to the conversation. I think that, being present carries a lot of weight these days, right? Being present. And so thank you very much for this conversation and allowing us to go on a little bit, a few tangents and invent some new metaphors that we can apply in our own businesses. And wonderful, everyone. If you're listening to the podcast, hit subscribe on Apple or Spotify. This always helps everything, and add some feedback or ratings. Those are awesome for everything. And this will be LinkedIn Live. It'll be out there forever. If you have any questions and you catch this off the live, just put them in there. Both Kevin and I will get notifications, and we'll seek to answer them. So thanks for listening. Thank you so much, Kevin, for your time today. This is super insightful. And take care, everyone. Have a great rest of your day. Take care.
Take care.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. That was awesome.
Rock and roll.